welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
And an uninterrupted... he tells me right before we start, don't interrupt me. And I'm like, oh,
I just left the door
man,
open for
her.
See if
just
she
like
listens.
Throw down the gauntlet. Okay, now I don't want to, so go ahead.
Okay. Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They've got a real good inventory right now of tractors and implements. Go up and see them. They also have a fully stocked parts department and service department ready to fix anything that's broken. So bring it on in or give them a call, 226-9226. They're located up in Shasta Lake City at 3119 Twin View Boulevard. Or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com. And they also have steel and...
No, there's more. What are you, Bill? What is it, Billy Mays?
Yeah, that's not all. They also have the steel power products and Honda power products. Get those while they last because California is going to ban all that stuff in...
Well, they think they are.
2023, I think.
Yeah, we're going to get rid of all gas-powered things. Yeah,
all small gas engines. Yeah, you can't have those in California.
Sense.
So you got to go out there with little hand clippers. But we have those, too. You can go up and get some hand clippers. You can get your lawn done and,
can you fix
know,
a Bose
so.
Radio?
No, probably not.
Oh, you said you can fix anything.
Yeah.
I was all excited there for a minute.
Yeah, so what do we got going?
That was kind of like interrupting.
Yeah, that was...
It was really a minor interruption.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's so hard not to do those things that come naturally, you know? Stunts my growth. Okay, so oddly enough, and you're going to think that we were really smart for doing this, but honestly, it was kind of an accident. It was just a timing thing that we have Dr. Peter Vincent Pry on with us today. And who better to talk about, like, Russia and Ukraine?
Oh, my God, we're going to war. It happened any time.
It's really funny. Everything I keep seeing is like 3-2-1. 3-2-1 is trending. 3-2-1. Everybody's 3-2-1.
Okay, really, really.
But for real.
For real, it's going to be any day now.
He had sent me an article, Ukraine crisis could escalate to nuclear World War III. And there was all this stuff, and I thought, he's on the 13th. That's... Actually, timing couldn't be better. So just in case you haven't heard any of our shows with Dr. Pry, I actually have a Dr. Pry tab at the top of the page, so you can find them all there swiftly. But today is February 13th, 2022. And what was I going to tell you? Before I do that, I was thinking we don't really talk about the archives much. They go back like 11 years. They're free to listen to. And, you know... back 11 years ago, we started that kind of Joe Rogan format long before Joe Rogan, the one where we had people on for the whole time and kind of just let them talk. So now that format is popular, so you might enjoy some of these older shows. They're not really out of date. A lot of the concepts are obviously so good. We like to talk about things that are always going to be mostly true. And just remember to look at the date of the show, however. So if we say something bad, like about the president, or we say something good, we always get hate mail, like, you hate Trump. And it was like, no, it was a show from before, from Obama. So just check the date. If you think we've lost our minds, it's usually a date problem. So Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both congressional advisory boards. He served on the Congressional EMP Commission and the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission. He also served on House Armed Services Committee. He was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy. He has a PhD in history and archaeology, another one in strategic studies, which is what led him to the CIA. He's also the author of numerous books, and I have those attached here on the page for today. The Power, I think he has a new one out, but The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMPs Commission's War to Save America, 2001 to 2020. That was the latest one that I have on the page, and I believe there is a new one either pending or out, and my bad that I did not attach it, but I will. Dr. Pry, is that an evil rumor that you have another book out?
No, I did publish another book recently in 2021 called Blackout Warfare, which describes what actually might happen soon in Ukraine and maybe in the United States, this new way of warfare that Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran have that does not use the traditional means of military power, armies, air forces, missiles, but uses cyber warfare combined with small special forces squads to go around and shoot up electric grids, cyber attacks to collapse the electric grids, non-nuclear EMP weapons, and then ultimately a nuclear EMP attack, which in the definition of our adversaries is a form of cyber warfare, to black out the electric grid. And this is a way of winning World War III almost literally at the speed of light. You know, they envisioned being able to collapse electric grids, which are the foundations of civilization. And, you know, you can't project military power without electricity, and it would render your adversary helpless. So we actually started to see some of this. Russia threatened to do it. Cyber attack that would black out part of the United States or the whole of the United States last April, when we had the last big crisis, when the administration was convinced that Russia might invade Ukraine. And the Kremlin basically threatened that, look at, you know, we'd win it. We can win a cyber war against you. We don't have to fight a traditional war against you. And, you know, and I think that if a war comes, it's going to start with that. You know, they would black out at least Ukraine, you know, possibly NATO Europe. And if they're really paranoid and fearful that the United States would become involved, and Russia tends to be really paranoid about everything, to attack the United States itself and black us out. Although in April they threatened that they might do a demonstration to show their power and deter us from helping Ukraine by blacking out just part of New York City, like Harlem. Or they specifically mentioned blacking out the state of Florida. Or they could black out the whole United States and just, you know, win the war that way. And Blackout Warfare is the first book written in the West that describes this new way of warfare, the way the Russians and Chinese and North Koreans plan to prosecute it.
Now, how would, if they were to try to black out Ukraine, how would they protect their own stuff from being affected by that?
Well, if you're doing it by cyber warfare, which is what they've done every year around Christmas, including this year, practicing to black out Ukraine, that doesn't affect their stuff. You know, it only,
right.
It only affects the Ukrainian electric grid.
And what about like an EMP, though?
You can use non-nuclear EMP to, you know, to basically be very focused and to focus on Ukrainian assets.
Okay.
But I just wrote an article this morning, which is to be published because the EMP Commission looked at this. And you could do a nuclear EMP attack. This is one of the things I'm warning about that could happen. You could do a nuclear EMP attack over Brussels. The weapon would be detonated at an altitude of 70 kilometers over Brussels, which is the headquarters of NATO in Europe. And the EMP field would extend all the way from Poland to include Great Britain. So all the NATO countries would basically be blacked out. That means our troops, the small number of troops the Biden administration has sent, would become prisoners of war. I mean, this would basically become, the EMP field would lay down a red carpet for Russian tank armies to reach the English Channel in days. You know, because when your grids are blacked out, you can't mobilize forces, you can't put fuel in your tanks, you can't communicate. You know, so they'd be able to, with very little opposition, to just roll across NATO Europe, and those 30,000 Americans that are trying to flee Ukraine, all of them would become prisoners of war. So that's how you could use the nuclear EMP, just strike at a place where the field, you know, doesn't affect your forces.
Right.
It would affect all of our forces, but it wouldn't affect any of theirs. And it just so happens that by detonating that weapon right over NATO headquarters in Brussels at 70 kilometers is just about the ideal place to do it.
Interesting.
Lovely. I figured out why I thought it was I thought it was the same book, because I have Blackout Wars on there.
Yeah, Blackout Wars is an older book I wrote,
right.
Which is also, I mean, still very relevant, because it's basically a handbook on how the average person can become an EMP activist. That book was mostly not written by me. It was mostly written by heroic state representatives and state senators who tried to protect the electric grids in their states or tried to pass some kind of legislation in their states that would start them on the path. And some of them were successful, others were not. And so it's a way for people who want to do this in their states to figure out, you know, what works and what doesn't. And there's two bills in that. There's an actual executive order. There's a blank executive order that any governor could sign in that book, and protect his state by fiat. And a bill, a blank bill. All you have to do is fill in the name of the state, and it would start your state on the path to getting protected. Of course, I knew that I wrote the book Blackout Wars, too, but I didn't quite anticipate that there might be the level of confusion, you know, between blackout warfare and blackout wars. But it was a 2021 book.
That's okay. I was just being dopey. But then I looked, I thought, oh, that's why I thought I already had it. It was just me.
Right. Well, you probably already have blackout wars, but blackout warfare is...
Yes, I have to
have. I may have sent you an electronic copy. I don't remember.
No, I don't have that, but I listed on the page. I have little thumbnail pictures of the books and stuff, so I'll add that in here. You know, the other thing, you were talking about legislation. You had sent us an email, and I did put that on the site for today, H.R. 4521.
How disappointing.
Yeah.
I mean, in one sense, it's thrilling to see that people like you and I, you know, have finally won the public policy debate over whether EMP is a real threat or not, you know, because there was a time when the left and leftist journalists were saying, well, anybody who believes in the EMP threat has got tinfoil on his head. And they were trying to use it to embarrass Republicans and misrepresent it as some kind of Republican obsession, far right-wing Republican obsession. All of that is a lie. None of that is true. You know, Democrat and Republican administrations alike, ever since we discovered EMP after the 1962 Starfish Prime high-altitude nuclear test, and we knew how dangerous it was to our military systems, Republican and Democrat Congresses and presidents have all supported investing billions of dollars to harden our military systems against EMP. But it was deeply classified, and we never ended up hardening our civilian critical infrastructures. We were counting on nuclear deterrence to ensure that we would be safe there.
Wouldn't you think that after the Texas thing, you know, that maybe that would have brought things a little bit more into the forefront?
Or even before Texas, after the California thing. When you had all those wildfires in California because the PG&E and the other electric utilities wouldn't even do proper vegetation management and weren't smart enough to replace power line towers that were over 100 years old.
Yeah, they're at fault for, but the vegetation management we can lay at the feet of the people who don't want them to cut anything. Had to actually write legislation so that they could clear vegetation from under the power lines, and that took, I should really go back and look, but it took forever for that bill to go through, years, to actually let them...
Because that was the environmentalist block and all that, right?
Yeah, even though it's on their easements, their right-of-ways, Pacific Gas and Electric, and I don't know about Southern California Edison, but I'm assuming same deal. So you get out into these Nowheresville areas where you have to carry power to get to the Somewheresville areas, you know, and the people that live in between, so it's not like it's blocking someone's view or it's going to be some big problem. But they were stopping all that. So there's enough blame to go around, I guess, is my point.
But going back to the EMP bill, you know, so even a woke President Biden and a woke Democrat Congress, now agrees the EMP is an existential threat and is trying to do something to protect the nation's electric grids and other civilian critical infrastructures against EMP, but it's way too little. If they follow the plan they're on now, it's way too little, it's way too late, and what they give with one hand for EMP protection, they more than take away with the other hand for saving us from climate change.
Yeah, you know, because that's obviously something we lay awake at night and worry about.
Shutting down coal-fired plants, which is the third most resilient form of electricity.
No hydro.
And planning to build these enormous solar and wind farms, you know, because the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. I mean, wind and solar are fine if you're going to try to run your house, you know, as a microgrid on an emergency basis or something like that. But to try to replace the existing generating systems with that or supplement them with wind and solar is really asking for trouble, just like the kind of trouble you got down in Texas, because those were the first systems to fail during the ice storm.
Oh, yeah, all the windmills froze.
Well, heck, and if you don't have a battery bank at your house, your solar doesn't work either.
And they destabilize the grid. They destabilize the grid, and that instability, you know, is an open door for cyber attacks and EMP to shut the whole thing down. It makes a very shaky house of cards. I mean, the grid is very vulnerable without the wind and solar already, but it adds to that vulnerability. It makes it easier to collapse the whole thing. So, you know, we're heading in the wrong direction.
Yeah. I forget who we had on, but we had somebody who was telling us that, I think it was Jesus Arredondo, was saying that, like out here in the West, when the sun goes down, there is this massive draw on the grid because then it all switches over from their solar and all that, when that all kind of cycles over. So anyway, we will be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find all sorts of good stuff about us, including all of our archives that are free to listen to, and they are uninterrupted at wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
And there you have it. All right. So, Dr. Pry, I was going back to the email that you sent us about this bill, H.R. 4521, and you had said that it spends $75 million annually between 2022 and 2026. But then it said $300 million, maybe enough to buy only 30 EHV transformers. So for people who don't know what that means or how crazy that is, I know you've talked about it before on other shows, but can you tell them what that means and
why it's important?
Yeah, a little overview on why that's silly.
Sure. I'll quickly address that, and then I hope we can go back to the original topic,
yes,
you know, which is why Ukraine could turn into a nuclear World War III.
Yeah, I wanted to go there, and I was tempted, but then I thought, gosh, we got this on.
I told her to go there. But,
Bill did.
You know,
Bill told me to.
Right.
Of course, I was just thwarting him.
Yeah. An extra high voltage transformer is basically the foundation of our modern electronic civilization. You can't run electric grids without them. You know, they are huge. They're as big as a house. They weigh hundreds of tons. What they do is they basically take electricity from someplace like Niagara Falls and then drive it all the way down to across long distances, like to New York City, where it gets stepped down so that you can consume it. But there's about 2,000 of them in the country, 2,000.
Wow.
Right? So the amount of money budgeted, you know, for the 4 years of this project is only enough to buy 30 of these EHV transformers. If you spend all the money on transformers, you know, that's not nearly enough to protect against an EMP or a solar superstorm that could destroy hundreds of these EHV transformers. And it doesn't make any sense. I mean, the idea of building a strategic transformer reserve, the EMP Commission, it's one of the first things we thought about. And any preparedness is not bad, since we have zero preparedness right now. But it's one of the worst ideas in terms of trying to get prepared. because the transformers are so expensive. And each of them is unique. You know, as the 30 transformers are not interchangeable with all the other EHV transformers. You know, you're going to have to choose which 30 transformers you want to replace. You know, because every one of them is made by hand and customized for a particular role. And if you've guessed wrong, there's other transformers that get destroyed, then the strategic reserve is that you've got of the small number of transformers has been wasted. And the whole idea that you could replace these transformers, the transformers that get destroyed, is pretty absurd in a post-EMP environment, because transportation systems will be disrupted, communications will be disrupted, societal chaos will be occurring pretty quickly, and the transformers are so difficult to move. You know, there's only three rail cars in the whole country that can handle their weight. You know, bridges have to be reinforced, the roads have to be widened. You know, it's like building the pyramid. You know, to move an EHV transformer, and especially if you're, you know, and replace it. It just makes so much more sense to actually protect the transformers that we've got, so they don't get destroyed in the first place. And that's what the commission recommended. And to the credit of the Biden administration, they also have, you know, those provisions in the bill. But what makes me nervous is the bill is entitled a strategic transformer reserve or something like that. Okay, it's not titled protecting EHV transformers. So the focus of the bill and the money appears to be on buying EHV transformers and doing the worst of the options, you know. So that's what that's all about, and that's just another. But there are other things. If whatever money they spend on hardening the transformers, they also include in the bill another one of our recommendations, which is designing future transformers so that EMP hardness is built right into them.
Mm-hmm.
And then and they also require or call for reestablishing the U.S. industry for making EHV transformers here in America instead of importing them from Germany and South Korea and China. As it turns out, you know, we buy a lot of our EHV transformers and other electric grid equipment from China, which is really insane. You know, because we've discovered the Chinese are building cyber back doors into these transformers and the SCADA systems too. And they can design these transformers so that they're more vulnerable to EMP. I mean, it's like buying your fighter aircraft or aircraft carriers from China, you know? So that's all. That's that bill, and that's its shortcomings. But going back to our original topic about why could this Ukrainian conflict turn into a nuclear World War III, well, we have some precedents for what can happen, you know, in Europe. I mean, in 1914, you know, we had the case where a single Serbian terrorist firing one bullet into the chest of Archduke Ferdinand set in chain a series of events that escalated into World War I. And in 4 years later, millions of people were dead as a consequence of that conflict. You know, it came as a surprise. Nobody planned it, that it was going to escalate out of control that way. But that's how you get into world wars. And why did that happen? How did that happen specifically with Serbia? Because it's actually relevant to today. 1914 and the outbreak of World War I is relevant to this moment. You know, and it was because of Russia's reaction to what happened with that terrorist assassination against Archduke Ferdinand, who was the Archduke of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which no longer exists. But it was a major power, and it was an ally of Germany. And Serbia was a client state of Russia, and it was considered Russia's Slavic little brother. You know, it had ethnic and religious ties to Russia. And Russia considered that relationship sufficiently important so that to deter the Austro-Hungarians from invading Serbia for the assassination of their archduke, Russia mobilized its armies. And because Austro-Hungary was allied to Germany, Germany mobilized its armies. And when Germany mobilized, France mobilized, and then Great Britain mobilized. And that's what caused World War I. once you started mobilizing, there was no going back from war. They had practiced fighting war many times, but nobody had ever practiced turning it off, you know, reversing the trains and all the rest. And it became inevitable once mobilization began. Similar miscalculations or greater miscalculations are possible today, you know, because the time scale for decision-making and the way things work in the nuclear missile age, decisions can have to be made in minutes or seconds. And the ability to miscalculate, you know, because we have much greater intelligence than we have, but also much greater capabilities to misinterpret that intelligence and make mistakes over it. The Ukraine is the new powder keg of Europe. They used to call the Balkans before World One the powder keg of Europe. And Serbia is the spark that exploded the powder keg. Well, Ukraine is a much bigger and more dangerous powder keg than Serbia ever was, because Russia's interests are much more wedded to Ukraine than they ever were to Serbia in 1914. I mean, Serbia in 1914 was a relatively trivial strategic interest of Russia's compared to Russia's stakes in Ukraine. And what am I talking about? What are the Russian strategic interests in Ukraine? Well, first, and the whole reason for this, or major, one of the most important reasons for this crisis, is that Russia fears Ukraine is going to join NATO. And the reason they fear that is because NATO, we foolishly expanded NATO to the east when we shouldn't have. I can't remember if I talked about that on previous shows, but when I was on the House Armed Services Committee, my job as a young staffer was to, I had the NATO enlargement portfolio, and they sent me to all of the present countries that NATO expanded into to visit with their political military leaders to see, you know, what their interest was in joining NATO, what were they going to bring to the table in joining NATO, what good could be done by having them come into NATO. And my recommendation to the committee, the Armed Services Committee, to its chairman, I had a private face-to-face with Mr. Spence, the late, great Floyd Spence, and told him, sir, if you want to have a future new Cold War with Russia and risk a nuclear war with Russia, then enlarge NATO to the east, you know, because their strategic paranoia is going to make them see this as a threat and a betrayal at the end of the Cold War. And these new East European countries that people were bringing in, their economies are ruined by communism, so they can't really defend themselves. They'll never afford to build up the kind of military forces that are necessary to defeat Russia. We're the ones that will have to come to their rescue, and we can't come to their rescue because we will never be able to build up conventional military forces that are powerful enough to be projected into Eastern Europe to defeat Russia. That's their backyard. You know, we can't defeat Russia in its own backyard. We could barely calculate that we could defend Western Europe when we're on a defensive posture, not projecting force forward, but holding off the hordes of Russian tank armies. We weren't sure we could even do that when we were at the height of our military conventional power. The only way we can defend these new NATO member states is going to be with tactical nuclear weapons and the threat of strategic homeland-to-homeland exchanges. And Americans shouldn't be asked to sacrifice their lives and their country for nations they can't even find on a map.
Right.
You know, nations like Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia and Slovakia, which are NATO member states today, and most Americans have never even heard about them, but we've been committed to go to nuclear war for their sovereignty.
How much border does Ukraine share with Russia, do you know?
Well, I don't know off the top of my head in terms of kilometers, but it's enormous.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's hundreds of kilometers. You know,
and that's why they see it as such a threat.
Sure, because if they join, you know, we let Ukraine into the Partnership for Peace, which is an interim step to becoming a NATO member state. So if you're a paranoid, you know, Russian KGB officer or Vladimir Putin ex-KGB officer, and you see America and NATO Europe letting Ukraine into the Partnership for Peace, you know, that's a sign to you that they're coming into NATO. And if they do come into NATO, that would give NATO the ability to forward deploy missiles and armies and air forces to eastern Ukraine, you know, which is only 300 miles.
I was going to say, it's not that far away.
Yeah, it's ideal. During Operation Barbarossa, when Nazi Germany attacked the Soviet Union, Russia, the last stage, you know, when everybody thought the Soviet Union was going to be defeated and there was no more hope, that was the staging area for this final blow, because they got so close to Moscow, 300 miles away, they thought, oh, there's no way the Red Army can stop them now. Fortunately, God intervened with an early winter, and the Germans weren't, and Hitler's stupidity, because the Germans weren't prepared for a winter war, and that's what saved them, plus the T-34. But in those days, when Barbarossa and the Nazi Germany had threatened to defeat them, you know, they didn't have the technologies we have today. You know, the better air forces, the missiles, the better tanks, you know. So 300 miles in 1941 was an existential threat to Russia that nearly met their doom. So you can imagine the Kremlin's thinking. Now, most people in the West, if you talk to a Republican and Democrat congressmen who are unified, almost all of them, behind the Biden administration, supporting Ukrainian sovereignty and getting us into this confrontation with Russia, they'll say, oh, America doesn't do Pearl Harbors. We don't do Operation Barbarossas. You know, the idea that we would threaten Russia, you know, is just not credible and shouldn't be given credibility. Well, from our point of view, that's true. And we don't do Pearl Harbors, and we're a very benign power. But Russia is a paranoid power. They have, their strategic culture is one of paranoia. They've been invaded many times. That very territory, Ukraine and the states that are now in the NATO alliance, Russia, it cost Russia 30 million lives to kick the Nazis out of that territory. They're called the Bloodlands. And they think they've earned the right for security at the cost of their 30 million lives, so that NATO shouldn't be moving in to this area. And they don't trust us. They don't trust us any more than we trust them. They think that we think the way they do. And that's just a natural thing to mirror image, you know, and say, oh, the other guy's value systems is the same as mine. And if they had the upper hand over us, yes, they would go and try to finish us off. And they don't think we're any better than they are. In fact, they think that we've been conducting, you know, a long new Cold War to try to undermine them. So well, that's one reason.
Well, and that, then we showed them our strategic prowess with Afghanistan, our withdrawal from Afghanistan. So
right.
I'm thinking that they're not too worried, but we've got to take a really quick break. And I was just the very first line of your article that is posted here that I hope people go and read. It's Ukraine crisis could escalate to nuclear World War III. But the first line reminded me of a song. What are the odds of that? President Biden's mismanagement could inadvertently bungle the Ukrainian crisis into nuclear World War III.
Mm-hmm. And he never bungles anything. So
no, he doesn't.
Chances of that.
Jethro Tull was way ahead of him back in the 70s. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People.
Saving their reasons for Sunday. Lions and tigers who wait in the shadows. They're fast but they're lazy and sleep in green meadows. Well, that's hunger in the jungle. Well, that's all right by me. Yes. Well, I'm a tiger when I want love. But I'm a snake if we disagree.
Yep, so America's playing Bungle in the Jungle, and the Russians are playing Burning Down the House. We were going to have a musical war.
Yeah, good luck with that.
So it's so frustrating. You know, Dr. Brian, what's that?
Okay, one of the things I love about your show is the opportunity to go into issues in depth.
Yes.
And we talked about Russia's first strategic interest, which is keeping Ukraine out of NATO. Could I go through the other strategic interests? There are three others. You know, another reason Russia doesn't want Ukraine joining NATO, Russia doesn't want to lose Ukraine out of its sphere of influence, is that Russian petroleum and natural gas pipelines mostly go through Ukraine to Western Europe. And this is a very important source of revenue for Russia. So they can't afford to lose that control of that territory, directly or indirect control. Another factor is that Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia, wants to reconstitute the USSR, wants to establish a new Russian empire comprised of the states of the former Soviet Union. And one of the biggest and most important of those former Soviet states is Ukraine. He also considers Ukraine historically to be a Slavic brother. And he's written about this. You know, Ukraine never had a history of being an independent nation until after the Cold War. It was, for 1,000 years, basically part of Russia. In fact, the Russian people originated in Ukraine. They were originally called the Kievan Rus, and they expanded out of Ukraine, but that's where Russia began. If they take over Ukraine, they'll be able to again pose an existential threat to NATO by their missiles and air forces and their land armies, the kind of threat that they posed during the Cold War, will be reconstituted, because Belarus, for all practical purposes, is already really part of Russia. Belarus is a puppet. The dictator Lukashenko is in Putin's pocket, and he will do whatever. Belarus is going to participate. If Russia invades Ukraine, Belarus is right with them. And the Russian army is right now on Belarusian territory, which, along with the Belarusian divisions, will invade Ukraine from the north, while Russia invades Ukraine from the east. So Belarus is already basically in Russia's pocket. And if they take over Ukraine, then that whole border along Poland's border, that big plain that goes from Poland to Germany to France to the English Channel, you know, which is the invasion route, you know, the Russians will be able to mass their armies and air forces and missiles to pose a mortal threat to NATO, you know, from staging areas in western Ukraine and western Belarus. And that's something that they, you know, very much want to do, you know, because just the threat of that could enable them to possibly destroy NATO politically, which is actually happening already while this crisis goes on. Now, maybe I should leave that for later.
Well, do you think NATO would react if let's say he does go into Ukraine? Would NATO react to that? I mean, they're not a NATO country.
They're not a NATO country, and Biden administration is, so far, has been smart enough to say that they don't plan to fight the Russians for Ukraine. The Biden administration has another plan, but it's not a smart plan. What we're doing right now, as we speak, is we're airlifting as many military supplies into Ukraine as we can get. You know, lethal military aid, anti-tank missiles, ammunition, all of that. And we have lifted the military restriction. There had been a legal restriction on military aid that we have provided to our NATO member states. There used to be a restriction on who you could provide that aid to. You couldn't send it outside of your borders. But Biden has lifted that. So all of the NATO member states are being encouraged to send aid to Ukraine. And they are. At least the United Kingdom is, and the East European NATO allies are doing that, sending equipment and weapons into Ukraine. And the idea is that this is supposed to deter, they're hoping that this might deter a Russian invasion by raising the cost so that it's going to be a lot bloodier for the Russians. And and Ukraine won't be such a, it's still going to be a pushover, but it'll cost them more, you know, to roll over Ukraine with all of these weapons being supplied into it. That's their reasoning. And then, to punish Russia further, the idea is to turn Ukraine into a new Afghanistan for Russia, so that, you know, when the Russian army is there subduing the Ukrainian forces, we'll keep feeding arms in from the neighboring NATO states, from Poland, Romania, Hungary, and further raise the cost. And this is the kind of a thing that I think this is just further proof of how the Pentagon has become so incompetent and politicized. You know, the political generals that came up with this harebrained scheme. You know, because first of all, by arming Ukraine, it assumes that we can avoid getting in a war with Russia by doing this, and that the Russians are going to cooperate with our plan by letting themselves get killed in Ukraine by U.S.-supplied military equipment, and they're not going to do anything about it. That is a really hopeful view of what's likely to happen. Just the fact that you're arming Ukraine, first of all, feeds Russian paranoia that we're lying.
Right.
And that Ukraine is a de facto member state, even if we haven't officially allowed them in. You know, and why won't we say, no, we're never going to let Ukraine into NATO? We won't say that. You know, we are keep leaving the door open. You know, General Stoltenberg and the Biden administration have both said, well, NATO is a collection of sovereign countries. We have the right to let Ukraine into NATO if we want to. We just don't plan to do it in the future. You know, we have no immediate plans and not even any long-term plans to do it, even though they're a partnership for peace. So stop worrying about it, Russia. But here we are, you know, arming them to the teeth. You know, it sure looks like we're acting as if Ukraine is a NATO member state. And it puts more pressure on the Russians to do something about it.
Exactly.
You know, I think the arms, instead of letting the situation cool off, the arms are much more likely to provoke an invasion, you know, because the Russia, because of the reasons that I just explained, that this is a vital strategic interest for Russia. It's a vital strategic interest for legitimate defensive reasons, but it's also a vital strategic interest, admittedly, for illegitimate aggressive reasons, you know. But if we end up poking the bear so that it invades Ukraine and they end up on Ukrainian territory, it's going to be much worse for NATO's security in the long run, because they'll be now 500 kilometers from the border of Germany, you know, with an overwhelming military force. I would point out that NATO today is not the NATO of the Cold War, but Russia today is pretty much the Russia of the Cold War. I mean, Russia has 20,000 main battle tanks, to just use one data point, okay?
Wow.
You know, the United States has only got today has only got 100 main battle tanks in all of NATO. Germany's whole army has got only 480 main battle tanks.
And Russia has how many?
20,000. And on this invasion path from Poland through Germany to the Benelux country and France, there's only a little over 1,000 main battle tanks on our side versus 20,000 on their side. And there's an enormous disparity in tactical nuclear weapons that we've talked about before on this show. In fact, as I mentioned earlier on this show, you know, we can't defend Poland and the Baltic states or any of those East European NATO members unless we use tactical nuclear weapons. And we would lose even then. According to the RAND Corporation, we can't even win at the tactical nuclear level because Russia has got an enormous advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. They've got 2,000 to 8,000 tactical nuclear weapons at least, and we have only got 180 of them. And most analysts don't think it through. I would say we don't really have any tactical nuclear weapons, because I'm going to make a prediction. If Russia did that EMP attack over Brussels, used that one nuclear weapon, super EMP weapon, to black out NATO, you know, logically, you know, the U.S. strategic response, NATO's responses. Well, we've got tactical nuclear weapons, too, so we're going to retaliate against Russia.
Yeah, here we go.
But those U.S., they are U.S. tactical nuclear weapons stored on the territory of NATO. There's 180 of them in places like Germany and the Benelux countries and Italy, you know. But they're not delivered. You need authorization from the host government to use them. But the host government is supposed to deliver them, not us. So, you know, if you're Italy or Germany, even if an EMP attack has happened and has blacked you out, are you going to want to authorize a tactical nuclear strike on Russia from your territory, you know, knowing the disparity in numbers and and that they are certain to retaliate on your territory? You know, an EMP at least hasn't destroyed your, burned your cities to the ground or killed thousands of your people yet. It's just blacked out your electric grid, you know. But if you use tactical nuclear weapons, you're likely to escalate it to call it a real nuclear war, you know, with Hiroshima and Nagasaki type scenarios going off on your own territory. So in reality, the idea that we've got 180 tactical nuclear weapons is, I think, a myth, because it's dependent on our allies being willing to use them, giving us permission to use them, and then themselves, you know, being willing to execute that. NATO Europe has always expected the United States to defend them through extended deterrence. So the nuclear war is supposed to be fought over their heads between Russia's homeland and our homeland. That's been their plan, you know, but the Russians know that, and this plan, you know, gets around that. So the these are some of the, let me talk about more specifically in terms of, let's go through the chain of escalation. Let's suppose the Biden administration plan works, and they do make it more bloody for Russia to invade Ukraine. Let's suppose they make it sufficiently difficult that Russia has to resort to tactical nuclear weapons. So they've crossed the tactical nuclear threshold. That's what the outcome could be if you're successful in the Biden strategy, that the Russians are resorting to tactical nuclear weapons to take out the Ukrainians. Let's suppose that their strategy is successful enough so that the Ukrainians, I mean, it can't be successful enough for the Ukrainians to win. The disparity between Russia and Ukraine is just too great.
What is the ground force size of Russia? I mean, how big is their army?
Oh, they have 1 million men in their army. They have 120,000 mobilized on the border of Ukraine. Our television has been full of reports about America sending thousands. You know, we've sent 3,000 troops.
Big deal.
The 8,500. Altogether, we have about now, after the Biden reinforcements, we have about 10,000 troops spread across the frontier of NATO in Eastern Europe. 10,000 across thousands of kilometers on that frontier. Most of them are concentrated in Poland opposite Ukraine to help receive American evacuations and help the Ukrainians from a distance if they can. But, you know, that means the Russian forces outnumber us. Just the ones that are going into Ukraine, not the whole Russian army, million-man army, but just the forces that are going to go into Ukraine outnumber us by 12 to 1. And our guys are in penny packets. They're not organized, you know. They're spread out among many countries. So, you know, those guys, if the EMP attack happens, or if the Russians, if the Ukrainian army has to execute a fighting retreat because we've enabled them to do so by beefing them up, you know, maybe they can execute a fighting retreat into Poland or Romania and Hungary.
What a mess.
If the Russians follow them, if the Russians follow them to finish the job, then they've invaded NATO.
Yeah. Your article, World War III. We're coming. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He'll be here in the second hour, and so you're going to learn all sorts of interesting things.
Yeah, the scenarios.
If you've missed part of this or want to send it to other folks, you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
With the light.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pat Bay Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They've got everything you need. If you need to go out and cut your grass or plow your fields, go down and see them. They've got pretty good inventory right now. And I hate to say it, but it looks like spring has sprung. 80-degree days in February.
When winter comes back, our trees are going to be shocked.
Yeah, it doesn't bode well, but the grass is growing like crazy right now. So go talk to the guys up there. They can get you fixed up. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard between Oasis and Pine Grove, right just south of Phil's Propeller. You'll see a big Pat Bay sign. So go up and see them or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at patbaymachinery.com.
You were supposed to say they could fix anything.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know.
I was going to ask you. Can they fix a hi-fi?
Yeah, can they fix a hi-fi? No, they can't fix a hi-fi. Yeah. And don't leave your record player playing for the kids at night. It's probably not going to work either.
Just in case you hadn't seen
What's Up, Doc?
What's Up, Doc, lately? Can you fix a hi-fi? Good grief. Okay, so this, I don't know. What do we call it, Dr. Pryde? Do we call it the disaster with Russia or Ukraine?
I thought it was very interesting that we're having this conversation about a situation that isn't merely theoretical, but it's real. And it could happen within days. And it's like in real time, this radio show is tracking unfolding.
I know. That's why I thought it was so weird that you were going to be on this week. I thought, well... That was kind of handy.
That we just had. There was an announcement that President Biden talked to dictator Putin over the weekend about the Ukrainian situation and warned him, you know, that there were going to be severe consequences from the United States and NATO.
Unspecified
severe consequences, but that it better that we were not going to just stand by, all right? That we were going to act to punish Russia if they invade. And it was, again, unspecified whether he's just talking about military or whether he's talking about economic sanctions. And we have, we talked before the break about how Biden has moved in, inadequate, you know, these thousands of troops that they talk about as if it's a large number when it's really such a small number. Why did we do that? Why have we got our guys strung out there in such small numbers? This is the classic nuclear tripwire. You know, this is the same thing we have in North Korea. We've done it elsewhere around the world. When you have such small numbers of American troops in the forward deployed area, the idea is that the bad guys know that if they kill the Americans, they're going to bring America into the war, and that America will then have the right to engage in nuclear escalation. You know, and so that's these two things in combination. You know, Biden warning Putin and us having this nuclear tripwire on the Ukrainian border, you know, again, raises the stakes that this thing could escalate out of control and turn into a nuclear war. And if you're one of the scenarios, it plays right into one of the scenarios I described in my article, you know, which is if you're Russia and you're going to go into Ukraine and you know that the Biden administration plans to try to turn Ukraine into Afghanistan by feeding arms in from the neighboring NATO states, then why should you tolerate that? Why not, since you can walk over these states in 72 hours and conquer them in 72 hours, why not do that? And it would isolate Ukraine so that we can't feed arms into Ukraine and turn it into an Afghanistan. And it increases Russia's defensive debt by recapturing countries that used to belong to the Warsaw Pact. The other thing is that if they think that we might escalate to the tactical nuclear level, which is the only way we have of trying to defend these forward NATO states, then why would they allow us to do that? It would be very easy for them to launch a preemptive strike on the small number of bunkers in NATO Europe to disarm us of our tactical nuclear weapons. And Biden's phone call to Putin might have him thinking about whether he should do that now, because, you know, maybe Biden is thinking of trying to use tactical nuclear weapons, hoping that the Russians fear them as much as we do, and that it would be taken as a reason for Russia to seek an exit. But he probably doesn't understand Russia's nuclear strategy. You know, they're not as afraid of nuclear war as we are. They took 30 million dead in World War II. They're used to taking enormously enormous numbers of casualties in order to achieve their geostrategic goals. We are not. We have no history except the American Civil War of making a similar sacrifice.
Well, he had a conversation the other day, or he made an announcement at a press release that said Americans need to get out of Ukraine, because if they don't, there will be no rescue missions. There'll be nobody coming in to save. Well, what's that telling Putin?
Right. You know, that's telling Putin that he's trying to clear Americans out of the war zone. And we don't know what's going to, you know, it could be read by the Russians as another sign that the United States will be using military force, maybe even nuclear force, to try to save Ukraine.
Wow.
You know, we can't project enough conventional military power, and we certainly haven't prepositioned any that's credible as a means of rescuing Ukraine. The only way we could do it, you know, is with tactical nuclear strikes. And then finally, the final ladder, well, it's almost the final level ladder of escalation here, the way these things could get out of control, that if Russia did decide to launch a preemptive strike on NATO tactical nuclear bunkers, they would also know that that would, in theory anyway, bring in the U.S. strategic nuclear forces, you know, because the tactical nuclear bunkers are a tripwire for the strategic nuclear forces. And so why let yourself take that chance, you know, since they also have the ability to launch a disarming preemptive strike against the American homeland? They could do it with EMP and cyber warfare, too, by the way. And so instead of actually blowing up missile silos, but the Russians are very conservative military planners, you know, there's a real good possibility that they would do both. And then finally, the China issue, you know, because Washington, you know, we have talked maybe as long as I've been a guest on your show, we've talked about how Washington doesn't get that China and Russia really are allies. You know, they have a strategic alliance, and they're working together and cooperating. And the bloc includes North Korea and Iran. And this is the bloc that we face in the new Cold War. It's the most powerful and most dangerous combination that we have ever faced, ever. North Korea is far more dangerous to us. Just take one part, one of the smallest parts of the new bloc. North Korea is more dangerous to America than Nazi Germany was in World War II, or Imperial Japan, or both of them combined, because it's got hydrogen bombs on ICBMs that can reach anywhere in the United States. You know, that's just North Korea. And, you know, China and Russia also have nuclear arsenals. I think Iran has also got the bomb.
Well, have they established that their nukes can reach U.S. shores?
Yes, they demonstrated that back in July of 2017.
Oh.
More than once. You know, in fact, I was actually called to the White House to brief the National Security Staff on the day after the 4th of July. On July 5th, they flew me up there from Florida. You know, because they were taken by surprise that North Korea had developed ICBMs that could reach the United States. I wasn't taken by surprise because the intelligence community has been assuming that. I'm just not stupid, okay? I acknowledge the facts and go where the facts lead me, and
yeah.
We know and should know. You know, it's not an accident. The intelligence community likes to think that the Iranian and North Korean nuclear and missile programs are what they call indigenous. In other words, they're almost entirely dependent on the scientific, technology, and industrial base resident in North Korea and Iran. But there's all kinds of evidence to indicate that that's not the case, and that these countries are client states of Russia and China, and that the nuclear threat from Russia, from North Korea and Iran is based on Russian and Chinese technology. We even know that there are Russian scientists helping the North Koreans, and there are North Korean scientists helping the Iranians. And, you know, So that's how come that, and it's just common sense if you look at it, when you think about, well, how the heck did North Korea so quickly advance its nuclear program?
Right.
It went from atomic bombs, it's got super EMP weapons, it's got mobile ICBMs, now it's got hydrogen bombs that can hit the United States. North Korea has got, there are only three countries in the world that have mobile ICBMs, mobile intercontinental ballistic missiles that can deliver a hydrogen bomb to the United States. There's Russia, China, and North Korea. Not even the United States has got a mobile ICBM like that, okay? How did the heck did North Korea get ahead of us?
Yeah.
You know, that's how. Because they've been helped all the time. There was a parade with mobile ICBMs, and the North Koreans forgot to take the sticker off the cab of the TEL. It's a transporter, electric launcher. It's basically a mobile launch control facility. It's a very complicated thing. It's not just a flatbed truck. That's enormously complicated. It's like having a mobile Cape Kennedy to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile. And there was a sticker on the cab in the parade, visible to international television, that showed it was made in China. You know? So, anyway, but that's sort of getting us off the track from Ukraine, I suppose. But, so the final ladder of escalation would be a global nuclear conflict with Russia and China, because China, if Russia invades Ukraine, China is very likely to attack Taiwan and the South China Sea to annex for those areas as well, because it knows that's a perfect opportunity. The United States can't handle a two-front war; it can't win in a contest with Russia or China fought in their backyard.
Yeah, there's never really been a better opportunity for them to actually succeed on a two-front war in a very long time against the United States, has there?
Yes. And we've had 18 war games, at least 18 war games, with China versus with the United States opposing China in a Taiwan scenario, and we've lost every one of them. So our own analysis shows we can't win over Ukraine, and we can't win over China. Now, to go back to something I alluded to earlier in the conversation, that Russia may be able to destroy NATO, may be in the process of doing so, even as we speak. They may be able to win without war. Another topic that we often come to in this on this show when we talk about this. And the sign of it is that, you know, the Biden administration has put a tremendous amount of pressure on its NATO allies to send arms to Ukraine. And as I said, many of them are. But Germany is not. Germany has refused to send arms to Ukraine. And Germany is being lambasted by the Biden administration and by other NATO allies for not sending arms to Ukraine. Now, we don't think much of Germany here in America, but among the European NATO states, Germany is the heart of the NATO alliance. It's considered the strong man of the NATO alliance. You know, even though it's weak compared to Russia, it's the strongest NATO member state, you know, of all of them. And the fact that Germany, why is Germany not sending arms to Ukraine? The common wisdom that's given out in the mainstream press and by the Biden administration is that, well, it's because Germany is dependent on Russian natural gas. And this is a sign of, you know, how Germany can be coerced by Russia. And I think that's partly true, but I don't think it's mostly the explanation for why Germany isn't sending arms to Ukraine. And I think the real reason, or the more fundamental reason, that people don't even think about or don't want to talk about is because in the last century, Germany was on the losing side of two world wars. And it paid an enormous price for being on the losing side in two world wars.
Mm.
You know, in World War II, every city in Germany was destroyed. Germany had the experience. It knows what it's like to be invaded by Russia and occupied by Russia. During the Battle of Berlin, there was the greatest number of rapes ever committed in human history. And the dead the dead, not the total casualties, were 5 to 7 million. And that's within the living lifetime of some Germans. It's a lesson that even the woke political leadership of Germany has not forgotten. They're not sending arms to Ukraine because they're afraid of what we've been talking about. And I don't think the Biden administration gets what NATO is really about these days. NATO is about...
They're busy worrying about pronouns and, you know... I mean, their greatest insult is is to misgender you. I don't think those are the people who should be calling the shots.
European NATO, the Europeans love NATO and want to and cling to NATO for security, for safety, for peace, because they think the United States is going to take all the risk for them. They don't want a big European war. They don't want to be at risk themselves as being in the front line. And the closer we move, the closer the Biden administration moves NATO to the possibility of a big war with Russia, the weaker and more fractured the alliance will become, perhaps to the point of disintegration, you know, without an actual war even occurring, because they will calculate, just like the way a lot of Americans calculate. Hey, we want to get out of NATO. How does it serve our national interests?
Yeah,
right?
What has NATO done for us lately? Well, that was the whole big fight during the Trump administration. We have to take a really quick break, Dr. Pry. We'll be right back and stay on this thread. I feel like we're actually plotting the movie script for Wag the Dog, but that movie was already made. And anybody who hasn't seen it, I think we're living it.
Yeah, but this is much more real.
Well, it is obviously much more real, but I mean, it's crazy that they're walking us into this the way they are. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
And I wonder if I'm really with you now, or just chasing after some finer day. Anticipation is making me late. It's keeping me waiting.
That dancing girl is making eyes at me. I'm sure she's working for the KGB in this paradise.
And it's getting closer. So what are they, I don't know how I want to ask this, but like, what are they not telling everyone that you're looking at thinking, oh my gosh, if people knew this, they would be freaking out?
Well, one of the things I think the Biden administration, it's not what they're not telling, it's what they don't even see.
Oh.
And one of the greatest dangers and weaknesses we have among all Western governments and the elites that run them is a lack of self-awareness about the profound divisions that they have caused within our own policies. You know, we're being told by the Biden administration, by these elites, that the West has to... Why are they doing this irrational thing that doesn't serve U.S. national interests and doesn't serve the national interests of any of the NATO member states? They're doing it because they're globalists. And the globalist philosophy is distinctively anti-nationalist. They think patriotism and nationalism and pursuing the national interests are evil. And they're trying to build a new world order based on international law, international courts, the United Nations, and things like that, you know, that would impose our secular humanist values on the rest of the world, expecting them to follow our example or be persuaded by our logic. That's what the real agenda is. They appeal to patriotism and things and make claims about them. That's why we find ourselves fighting wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan and elsewhere, you know, because the globalists are trying to use the engine of the United States to advance the globalist agenda. They're willing to spend our blood and treasure on behalf of that, not on behalf of U.S. national interests. If the U.S. is destroyed in the process of building globalism and we all become one world citizens, then it will have been worth it. They don't tell us that. That's what they think. But you can tell people are catching on to this by the way we are increasingly treated. Because our own governments, I mean, they talk about defending democracy in Ukraine. What about defending democracy in America or in any of the NATO European member states? These globalists are becoming so bold and overconfident in their power that they're trying to impose left-wing values and concepts that are really fantasies. They're panicking about climate change, their belief in 32 different genders instead of two biological sexes, you know, theories about faith in socialism when it's proven it doesn't work. And those of us who oppose those values are increasingly regarded as an enemy, a potential domestic violent extremist. These governments that profess that they want to defend democracy in Ukraine are themselves becoming increasingly authoritarian.
Yeah, they're the same people that want you to house the homeless in your house.
Right, and they're becoming authoritarian to the very people who fight their wars and make these societies work. And this is probably the greatest weakness that we have in the West right now, you know, because they have for decades scorned the national interest and scorned patriotism. And when the if the call goes out to die for Ukraine, you know, Americans are not going to heed that call and shouldn't. You know, Ukraine isn't worth one American life. You know, it doesn't serve America's interests. Nor does Kazakhstan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and all these other countries that Russia eventually wants to take over, or maybe sooner that rather than later wants to take over, because they were part of the former Soviet Union. So that's the thing. There's this lack of self-awareness. They're unaware that we're in a civilizational crisis themselves, and the West can't afford to get in a world war. We're even losing before there's a war, as I mentioned with Germany. You know, the yeah. center is not holding in European NATO. You know, they're already bailing out. You know, we could end up with a new world order, you know, dominated by Russia and China and the other bad guys, even without a war happening, because Biden pushes this thing so far that the structure of international security that has been built up over many decades falls apart. Because it's not supported by anybody but the elites, you know, and who subscribe to globalist theories, you know, in Europe and Asia and the United States. So that's
how big of an impact does the whole Afghanistan debacle have as far as Biden and China, as far as showing what kind of military leadership we have?
Yeah, I've been arguing that part of the main reason has been ideological. And I certainly think that that explains, you know, why most of the NATO European governments, you know, are getting involved in Ukraine. But where Biden is concerned, the Afghan debacle, there could be a lot of the explanation, too, could just be crass partisan politics, because he knows his credibility was really damaged in Afghanistan. And what I'm afraid of is that General Miley, the chief of the general staff who bungled Afghanistan, might just be stupid enough to be telling Biden that he can fight a glorious little war against Russia in Ukraine and keep it contained so it doesn't turn into a world war. And we will come off looking good enough so that we'll distract the American people from Biden's domestic failures at home and cover him with glory. And that's what authoritarian states do. And we're a soft authoritarian state now. You know, I don't consider us a constitutional republic anymore. You know, we're an authoritarian state. We're the pretty much a one-party system, you know, that dominates all the major instruments of power. And that's how authoritarian states think. You know, when they have domestic troubles, they'll often get into war, hoping that patriotism will unite the people behind their failed leadership. And a similar phenomenon, that could be an explanation for, you know, why Biden, an additional explanation in addition to the, you know, globalist ideological thing.
Yeah, that's really what it looks like, too, is let's have a little war and everybody will rally around us. And,
wag the dog.
Yeah, that's really
we'll be the good guys, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
When what we should be doing is trying to make peace with Russia. We should be promising Putin, look, we're not going to let Ukraine into NATO. We're not going to expand NATO further east. It's not in America's interests to do that.
Why won't they say that? Why? What keeps them from actually saying that out loud? Why do they leave that door open?
I think the globalist agenda prevents them from saying that out loud. They want to see, you know, the influence of the West, the so-called, call them Western democracies, quotes around democracies, but basically the influence of the secular humanists, you know, elites, you know, who run these governments. They want to see that influence extended worldwide. They want to see a world order dominated, not by the United States, but dominated by these internationalist institutions that we were talking about. The United States is expendable in the cause of establishing that new world order. A world order that they probably think in their fantasy world that they're on the verge of achieving or nearly able to achieve because they don't understand, you know, how the waning of the power of the West, our economic power, the waning of our military power, you know, that we are not the power that we were back at the height of the Cold War under Ronald Reagan,
right,
or the power that we were in the aftermath of World War II. You know, they don't have a self-awareness about how they have weakened us economically, militarily, and morally in terms of people being willing to sacrifice, you know, for these causes.
Right, right. I have a question. It's a little bit off topic, but
what?
I think we all know that Sleepy Joe's not calling the shots here. In your opinion, who's behind the scenes pulling these strings and getting us into this whole thing? Who do you think that is?
Well, I agree with you. It's not Biden himself.
No.
You know,
he's the mouthpiece.
The staff that's run, his donors, the big tech guys that have, you know, vast wealth and who got him elected president in the first place, the various things like the Council on Foreign Relations that represent the views of our universities and academics, the State Department bureaucracy, you know, who believes in arms control and international relations, and they're supposed to be representing American national interests, but they have not done so since 1945. You know, they've been pushing, you know, globalism, you know, since then. So I think those are the influence. The permanent bureaucracy within the U.S. government at the, you know, upper levels of the State Department. And, you know, I think that's where and of course the media moguls, you know, who have long been anti-American and despised patriots and rejected the traditional values of America. You know, this is, this cabal of, private sector and, I don't want to call them public because they don't represent the public, but government, interests. You know, are the ones that are calling the shots. But it might be a little too optimistic to say they are calling the shots. I think in a lot of ways it's a rudderless ship. They got him into office. They have tremendous influence. But I don't think there's a particular evil genius or a panel of evil geniuses who are telling Biden what to do in Afghanistan. You know, I think they got him into office, and they control the broad contours of domestic and foreign policy and mm-hmm. defense policy. They control the broad contours. But when it comes to the specific decision making, you know, I think it's, surrounded by people like Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken
Kirby.
The Deputy Secretary of State. Yeah, Kirby's just a press spokesman. I can't remember her name now, but our Deputy Secretary. Her name escapes me. But those people on the National Security Council who are really have no depth of knowledge and,
Yeah, I agree. That's the whole thing. They really don't have any experience with this.
Yeah, they did a bad job when a lot of these people were in under Obama, and now they're all back again.
Yeah. Susan Rice. Oh. What was that other? There was a particularly idiotic woman who was...
Yes, I know who you mean.
I can't remember her name. Yeah, she was a friend of Hillary. She
yep.
used to be the Maryland director of child...
Purple hair girl?
No, that's a...
And then she became the director of Emily's List, which was designed to get Democratic politicians who support abortion elected. And she became a friend of Hillary, and they put her in the State Department. And she then suddenly became, without any background in strategic studies or international relations, but she became a big player in the State Department and consequently gave us such disasters as the... agreed framework with North Korea that helps North Korea become a nuclear weapon state, and the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with the Iran nuclear deal, and now she's involved in trying to preserve peace in Ukraine. I have more confidence if we had some evil geniuses because they might be smart enough to reverse course. You know, but I'm afraid we don't. We have children at the helm.
Yeah,
right.
And
they're much more concerned about what the next headline in the New York Times or the Washington Post is going to look like than they are about America's long-term national interest.
Well, they're
that's
also
how they make their decisions.
Well, they're also terrified that Biden's numbers are down, and so then all of a sudden the decisions all seem
blinders
to be about that. How can we?
Yeah,
how can we look better? Which is obviously
right.
how we want to run our foreign policy. Got to take another quick break, and then we were going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Don't turn around.
Pretty frightening, but you know the chances are so small. Stuck by bee sting, nothing but a bee thing. Better chance you're gonna buy it at the mall. But it's a 23 or 4 to 1 that you can fall in love by the end of this song. So get up, tell the bookie, put a bet on not a damn thing will go wrong. The odds are that we will probably be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright tonight.
I was going to play It's the End of the World and We Know It, and then I thought, we probably got everybody going for the steak knives already. Probably better put something on more cheerful. Try to save it at the end here. Oh, Dr. Pry, this just looks like... It looks like we can't get our hands around it, you know, that these guys have got so many of their people in all these spots and that they're just going to drive us off the cliff and we're trapped in the back seat.
Yeah, I mean, I think that pretty much captures it.
Huh, that's so much for my happy song.
Yeah, that's what I'm very worried about.
Yeah.
And all we can do is leave a record for a few archaeologists of the future.
Right. We're going right for the time capsule.
Yeah, to see that there were some sane people,
yeah,
you know, around, you know, who at least understood, you know, the fall of the American Empire, as it were, just like the fall of the Roman Empire, when we try to reconstruct that mystery. And there are, you know, a handful of people like Seneca and Tacitus, you know, who knew what was happening and could see it happening in front of their eyes, but were helpless to do anything about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, and the thing that's crazy is, like, I had somebody called last week at work and was all mad. You know, we need to defund the military. We're putting entirely too much money into all of these. It was kind of funny because first thing he listed was tanks, which, in light of the statistic you left us with earlier, I'm thinking, okay, well, we've pretty much done that. You know, we have all these armaments and we don't need them. Yeah. And there are a lot of people who think that. And here we are.
Well, you know, so many misinformed people, you know, because our mainstream media, their main source of information has been taken over. You know, we're not a free society anymore in that respect either. You know, the point of view that that I represent and that you represent doesn't have anything like its representation as a percentage of the population in the press.
True.
You know, we're confined to podcasts and in very small forums, you know.
Although
we have the Washington Times, and we've got.
I do have to put a plug in, though. I got to watch you on Mark Levin's show, where he actually let you speak for quite a while, and I was really glad of that because he's got a big audience.
Yes, that's right. But even so, you know, it's a. In terms of the percentage of our population,
right.
we don't control anything like that percentage of the mainstream media, you know, and they don't want to have a dialogue or a conversation that's based on science or facts or on strategic analysis. You know, they can't hold up their end of the argument, and so they dismiss us as crazy, illegitimate, as misinformants. You know, our articles and spokespeople, you know, are not allowed a place in the public square, you know, when it comes to, you know, Facebook and areas where people, you know, end up making, where the conversation happens. So a lot of people are misinformed. Just today, or was it yesterday, I saw that there was a new report out by Plowshares. They're sponsored by the Carnegie Foundation, you know, calling for the United States to unilaterally draw down its nuclear deterrent. How can anybody rational be saying that in the middle of this crisis?
Sure.
You know, but that's what they are doing. It reminds me, we've reached that phase in our civilization, I'm afraid, you know, where our elites are disconnected from reality, and they live in a kind of a fantasy world, you know, where they really do think and have convinced themselves and drunk their own Kool-Aid, you know, and they think climate change is the biggest threat, and public policy should be based on not two biological sexes but 32 genders, and socialism is the way of the future for organizing an economy. And
then my favorite, men can have babies. Don't forget that one.
Yeah, men can have babies. Just these crazy ideas. It's just, you know, we've got Neros and Caligulas and Commoduses in charge of our institutions, and you can win wars and be a superpower, but at the same time, you know, neglect your military and chase the best officers out because you want to force them to get COVID against their conscience, you know, COVID vaccines against their conscience, you know, chasing out exactly the kind of people from the military who are
needed right now
for a democratic system, because an army that serves a free people, you want your officers to obey their conscience. You know, you don't want them to be like the kind of officers you have in Russia and China and North Korea, who are automatons and don't think for themselves but will do exactly what they're told, including having drugs that haven't passed the FDA test that might be harmful to you injected into their bodies.
Exactly.
That's not the kind of an army you want for a free people.
Well, the funny part is we see it in Canada. I mean, really, when people in Canada are protesting, you're obviously really, really, really coloring outside the lines. The Canadians are, they're not fighters. I mean, this isn't, you know, they're not having urban warfare, but look at what's going on up there. They have had it.
Yeah, and I'm disappointed we're not following their good example.
Well, like, kind of think that our guys are gearing up. The bad part is that we've got all of our three-letter agencies that are poised and ready to ring these people out, and they're still ringing out the July 6th folks. So I think that's given people pause.
Right.
The silencing, that was the point, right?
Right, and part of the problem, an enormous part of the problem, is that we are a one-party system. You know, the Republican Party isn't a real opposition party. You can just tell that about their attitude toward the January 6th protesters, because that's what they were. They were protesters.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't terrorists the way Black Lives Matter were.
Insurrectionists.
They weren't terrorists the way Antifa was. You know, those are genuine insurrectionists. And the alphabet soup of agencies didn't do anything about them. They've gotten, you know, major corporate contributions and the like. They're supported. But that's an enormous part of the problem. The American people have suddenly discovered that we really don't have any representation. I mean, there's a handful of brave politicians like Governor DeSantis, Ted Cruz, who speak out, but again, it's a minority.
Well, and the people who won't do the right thing and who are advocating for the right stuff, they get zero airtime. So honestly, if you look at how would we know if any of the 535 people in Congress were doing the right thing? We only hear from six of them.
Yeah, right. And we know they're not doing the right thing, you know, because the January 6th committee still exists and continues to grind forward. And all of this, these threats to our face from our own president, I mean, I was reading a newspaper the other day, so-called mainstream, that talked about the lie that the 2020 elections were stolen, as if it's just transparently clear that the elections weren't stolen,
right,
that they were legitimate. So you can't even have a dialogue with these people to say, you know, you have to prove to me that those elections were legitimate. You know, these same mainstream newspapers, when the Democrats, as they have since George W. Bush, have accused Republicans of winning elections illegitimately, and they don't want to recognize the legitimacy of the president. They didn't call the Democrats, never call them liars, you know. I think another part of the problem is the conservatives are, well, it's right in the Declaration of Independence, you know, that people are willing to suffer all kinds of injustices and indignities from the powerful because people are naturally conservative and very reluctant to change their institutions and overturn that to which they are accustomed, you know. But it reaches a point, you know, where tyranny becomes obvious. And to save yourself, you know, you have no choice but to rise up against it and have a duty, in fact, to rise up against it and cast it off. And, at least in the American Revolution, there was a movement, and there were elites, you know, and there was an organization, that established the framework for the American Revolution to happen. We're starting all over again here in the conservative movement, you know, with very few leaders, and even those few leaders are not revolutionary in what they talk about. I mean, the Republican Party, even on Tucker Carlson, what they're talking about is, oh, we're going to turn things around in the midterm elections, you know. Nobody has explained to me how we're going to turn things around in the midterm elections when nothing has been done to negate and reform the travesties that happened during the 2020 elections and that are still with us, you know. The ballot harvesting, the mail-in voting, I mean, which is one of the reasons why the Democrats have wanted to keep the myth of COVID around for so long, You know, they've been wanting to keep it around long enough so they can use it as a justification to steal all future elections.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe, yeah. There hasn't been major reform to prevent that from happening again. So I don't know how people can believe that our next election isn't going to go the same
way.
But
the crazy part
is the same thing again.
What's happening, I just talked to a guy the other day, truck driver, ready to go join the convoy, doesn't understand why more people aren't doing it, you know, that whole thing, totally fired up. This guy bends my ear for like 20 minutes, and then he goes, well, you know, I just stopped voting because, and I thought, okay, I just stopped listening. I mean, regardless of what you think of the process, I mean, go be an observer, go be a poll watcher, go work in your elections department, I mean, go do something, but for God's sake, just digging a little hidey hole and jumping in it, that fixes zero.
Yeah, I agree. People have got to vote, even, and I'm not encouraging people not to vote. They should go out to vote, even if they think it's not going to make any difference. I mean, it's one of your only opportunities to
well,
be
for
heard.
Heaven's sakes, like,
if
okay.
If only by the bad guys who don't want to see your vote, you know?
Yeah,
right.
Well, like people say, well, yeah, make them cheat at epic. Yeah, make them cheat at epic levels, like force them to. But like here in California, people are like, oh, I knew Newsom wouldn't get, you know, thrown out. Well, that was because a million Republicans, registered Republicans, didn't vote.
Hmm.
I mean, they didn't have to cheat. It wasn't required.
Yeah.
Right.
I'd at least like to make them cheat if that's what's going to happen.
That's why tyranny may win in the end, as it has throughout history. You know, humanity, unfortunately, has more often lived under unfree systems than free systems. It's much more common.
Keep hoping people will just kind of turn into Canadians, have enough, and go park in the middle of the street until somebody listens to them.
Well, that's also part of the solution.
Yep.
That's in the Federalist Papers, you know, that when all else fails, it's basically up to the people, even to use violence if necessary. Now, I don't think we need to use violence to throw the tyranny off our backs. I am heartened by two things. First, the precedent of the collapse of the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union in basically less than 2 years, which was relatively bloodless. I mean, those evil empires were the most sophisticated tyrannies in history. They had perfected tyranny, totalitarianism, to the point of a science. You know, and they controlled their vast resources, the KGB, the MVD, psychiatric hospitals, the gulag, and those elites thought they were in power. But the Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, was right that, you know, governments exist only by the consent of the governed. And I think beyond that, what they meant was that the idea of a nation exists only in the imagination of the people. When people lost faith in communism in those countries, and they realized that, they said, we're not realizing some kind of workers' paradise.
Paradise never showed up.
It's all a scam. These people are my enemies.
Dr. Pry, we have to unceremoniously cut you off. I hate that every time it happens again. We need to have you back, and we should talk about the Federalist Papers. You'd be a great guy to talk to about that. We will have you on again.
Well, I look forward to it.
For people who want to catch more shows by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, please look on our website at wethepeopleradio.us.
For good.